Thank you for joining me today. What is your name?
My name is George Zeno.
Okay. And thank you for coming. First off, I would like to know, how long have you lived in this area of Tacoma?
So I've lived in Tacoma about 2 years. I'm a recent transplant from Seattle.
Awesome. Where have you lived before?
So I am originally from Louisiana, in a town called Lake Charles, and which is in the western side of the state. It's probably the fourth largest city in the state of Louisiana. And then from there, we moved up to Kent when I was about 9.
What brought you to this area?
So my parents divorced when I was really young, I was 2. My father relocated to Seattle, hoping to get a job at Boeing like everyone else did at that time. And so we moved up to Seattle when I was about 9.
I'd like to learn a little bit more about your cultural background. What is something from your culture or homeland that you wish more people in this area practiced?
Sure. So I am coming from Louisiana, and coming from a French Creole family. My mother was Creole, and which is a blending of Spanish, French, and African communities together. Sometimes German is considered in there as well. But if you imagine the blending of people and language and food, then you would better understand what Creole is. And that dynamic of being Creole is a beautiful way of presenting life. And so one of the things I would love to have other people experience is our food, our gumbo, our jambalaya, our music, which is Zydeco. The way we treat people, which is about community and being community focused, is what I would really appreciate here in Tacoma seeing more of.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I'd like next question I'd like to know is what's your experience with microaggressions in this community or in other communities?
Well, you know, being African American, I experience microaggressions almost every single day. And I think that's pretty hard for people to hear because if you come from a dominant culture, primarily a white culture, you may not experience a microaggression. So you may not feel the same way as other people feel. An example of a microaggression that I experience every time I go shopping is when I walk through the parking lot of a mall, I can hear the clicks of doors being locked. I can hear people resetting, making sure that their car alarms are being set. And it's my presence that makes them think that. That's a microaggression because they've stereotyped my blackness over understanding who I am as an individual. So they don't see me as a college educated homeowner, contributor to society. They see me as a stereotype in their heads. And so therefore they see me as danger. That's a microaggression. So I hear doors locking, clicking, the click of door alarms and things like that quite a bit. That's a really simple microaggression that I experienced. I've experienced many more, but that's the one I would probably, other people that look like me can experience as well, relate to.
Do you feel a big difference between microaggressions and aggressions and how you feel about them?
So the thing about microaggressions, there's a misnomer about that. Misnomer means that people may think that a microaggression is, micro means small. So the aggression means something that is pushed on or forced upon. And so when people hear micro, they think small. But reality is that every time aggression happens, it feels like a cut, or sometimes people say it feels like a mosquito bite. Imagine experiencing that multiple times a day. Imagine you experiencing a mosquito bite 100 times a day. How are you gonna feel? How are you gonna react to that when it's 100th time someone's done something to you that day? You're probably gonna react in ways that people who are on the receiving end think it's done, like you're overwhelmed by that person's response. Like, but it was only something I said. Why are you reacting that way? Well, we go through multiple microaggressions and that builds up to a point where you get a breaking point where people are like, it's too much. I can't deal with this. So I'm going to react back to you in a way that does not make you feel good. Sometimes that's hard for people who don't look like me to experience back, because it can be exhausting being a part of the minority oppressed group. And if you're experiencing it multiple times a day, it can be overwhelming to the point where you feel like you need to lash back out to protect yourself.
That's definitely powerful. Discrimination and oppression exists in various settings. Can you share a personal experience of when you feel discrimination in or oppression in school, your work, or in the community?
Sure. I have many examples to give you, but one of the ones that probably means the most to you as a student is that when I moved from Louisiana to Washington State, I did not speak the same English as you do. I have a Creole background, and so I spoke Creole English. That means I have a different dialect of English than you would have growing up here on the West Coast. And so when I moved from Louisiana to Kent, the school district immediately said, your dialect of English is not accepted here. So we jokingly say I had a swamp accent when I arrived, right? Because I come from an area of swamps and alligators and all those other creatures you can imagine coming from a place like Louisiana. And immediately the teachers thought, well, he doesn't really speak English. Well, I was speaking English, but it was not the English that they wanted to hear. And so they forced me into speech therapy. So this is what I sound like now. I don't sound like I come from Louisiana. I don't sound like I have a Southern accent or a Louisiana accent, which is different than the South. But forcing of me going to speech therapy to give me a different dialect of English will tell you that the system, the education system around me, dismissed who I was as a person, as a human, and said that it was not accepted, that my voice was not welcomed. They needed to change my voice, the way I projected my voice, my dialect. And that's, to me, it was discrimination. I didn't know that until I went to college. So when I went to college I have a social science degree. And so when I studied anthropology, I learned that there is an African-American vernacular, which means we have a different dialect, a different imagination than the predominant culture does, the predominant white culture does. So what I was speaking as a Creole person was never wrong. It was just different. And that's hard for people to accept. Because if you're not from the normal environment of language, then you're going to be seen as the outsider, as someone who's different, the other, as we call it. And so that's challenging for someone who's young and doesn't understand why other people want to tell you that you're different and what you're saying is wrong. I was never wrong. I was just different. And that diversity of my voice was not accepted.
Does growing up feeling like your voice was getting silenced make you later, now older and more experienced, want to louden your voice or make other voices more heard that are different?
Yeah, for sure. I think that we're now in an era where your lived experience means a lot. That means that the things that I've experienced in my life need to be translated to other people so that you understand what I've been through. Because if you just make assumption about what my life has been because you're looking at me through your own eyes, through the way you see the world, that's gonna challenge my reality, because our two realities are never gonna be the same. I'm from an oppressed people. I'm from a lower caste of people, meaning that I am othered. I am not part of the main group. You are part of the main group. And so you have privileges and rights that I've never had or have had to fight for. Or if you go back through history, I've had to have amendments in our constitution to give me the rights that you were born naturally with. And so when we look at that as a whole, we have to better understand what is my responsibility as a person of who comes from a oppressed group to speak up and say, you know what, I have a different lived experience than you do. So your assumptions that you put on me are not real. Those are just in your imagination because you've never lived my life. So you can't guess my reality. I can tell you my reality is, but if you don't believe my reality, then you're going to continue to assume that you're right.
Okay. That's yeah. On a broader note, who has been a hero for you or an inspiration in the civil rights and social justice front?
You know, it would be really easy for me to point to all the big figures we know in life, you know, all the big figures we know in life, such as Martin Luther King and so on, or Medgar Evers. There's so many important people that we say are giants in our lives. In fact, what we talk about in our communities now is that we stand on the shoulders of giants, meaning that there's these great people who came before us who are no longer alive or may still be alive, who are our elders, who are on the front line to make change happen. When I think about my own family history, I think about my grandfather. My grandfather was one of 13 children, born to a white father who married a black Indian woman in Louisiana. And this is like 1915 when they, I'm sorry, 1915 when they got married. And so when you understand the challenges and the risks they took to recognize their love together, I see my grandfather's father and mother as my heroes, because they stood in the front of hate and said, love wins. And I continue to believe that every single day. My grandfather's oldest brother was the first, what they would call back then, colored person, was the first colored person to be tried for murder of a white person in the state of Louisiana and not to be convicted. Why? Because he defended his family from a sheriff and his henchmen who tried to commandeer his horse and buggy. And when we think about the risk that they took to stand up and say, no, this isn't right. You can't just take things from us because you want to take from us. You know, he stood his ground and he said, no, this is my wife and my baby. And you can't harm us because you just want something. You want our horse and buggy. And so, so he stood trial for that and was successful in fighting for his rights, his human rights. And so when I think about heroes, I think about him, because he fought not only a justice system that was not built for him, he fought an entire white supremacy. He fought the Klan who were trying to lynch him. And so when I think about heroes, it's easy for us to look at Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and all these great civil rights heroes. But I think about the people before them who stood up so that Martin Luther King could stand up, because Martin Luther King was not the first. He was in the middle of the journey. And so I think about the people who stood up at the very beginning of it and risked their lives. Some people did not make it and some others did.
I really appreciate you sharing that. That's a very moving story. Now, if you can recall your childhood, do you recall any experience or memory from your childhood where you learned a little bit about inequality?
For sure. You know, when we moved up from Louisiana to Seattle, the Seattle area in Kent particularly, my parents, you know, worked for different city governments, right? So my mom worked at the Port of Seattle. My dad worked for Metro bus system in Seattle. And, you know, they were the very first black professionals in those arenas. You know, this is the 1970s. There weren't a lot of black folks in the area who were working in these professional jobs. I saw my mom be completely discriminated against because of her race, and primarily because people didn't believe what she was saying, that she was being harassed. sexually harassed. We now have a Me Too movement to look at. She didn't have that. It was just her voice, her word, against a management system that was not built for her. It wasn't ever going to champion her voice. And so when she went through that experience, she stood up by herself. I had to watch her go through all these trials and tribulations about what it means to speak truth to power, meaning that she was never going to let herself be diminished to something smaller because of the people in front of her. She stood tall and she said, "This is not right. I'm being harassed and you should acknowledge this." And you know what? After 2 or 3 years of this fighting, she won. You know, and she helped change the way the Port of Seattle operated. And I'm very proud of her for standing up and standing tall, because she put a lot at risk. You know, it's easy for people to be dismissed at work because of who you are, your identity. And this is back in the 80s when, you know, we didn't have much of from our family. We grew up poor. And so she risked a lot of things to speak up, but she knew how important it was, not only for being Black, but being a woman. And I'm very proud of her for speaking up for that.
Yeah, culture plays a big role in people's lives. How do you identify ethnically?
You know, part of the challenge we have is, as being African American, is that a lot of folks like me have lost their roots because slavery disrupts understanding of who you are. There's only so much you can go back to in history. I come from an oral history background, meaning that there wasn't a lot of writing going on. As you can imagine, slaves weren't meant to be educated. And so there's not a lot of writing of our own history, of our own people. So tracing our roots back has been a challenge. I'm lucky that I come from a background where we actually have slave diaries in my family, where we can trace back my family ancestry to a certain point. And I think that is a blessing in its own little way, because we get rooted in our own identity of who we think we are. That's not true for a lot of folks around us. I'm lucky that I come from a place where in Louisiana, where my mother's side of the family is Creole, my dad's side of the family is descendants of slaves. They're two different worlds, and I'm lucky to be able to navigate both of those. You know, my dad's side of the family comes from a time where they had to help the shrimp industry. They weren't picking cotton like most people think slaves did. And on the other side, on my mom's side of the family, you know, they have that one little slice of slavery on their side, but that they were on the sugarcane side of things. So they weren't in the dangerous part of the agriculture belt that most people understand. So today I see myself as Afro-Creole, meaning that I come from an African background on my father's side, but I recognize myself as Creole, coming from a blending of life on my mother's side, which is African, Spanish, French, and European.
How does that culture play a role in your life?
Well, it plays a significant role in how I see the world. I see the world in a space where people should be collaborating together, because I come from a people that is community-based in that sense, because my ethnicity calls for that. I come from a language. I come from a food. I come from a way of life that's completely different than the rest of America. That's the beautiful thing about Louisiana, especially the southern parts of Louisiana, which are the French heritage parts. We come from gumbo and jambalaya and etouffee and po' boys, things that are not imagined in any other space than Louisiana. And so I'm proud of that. I'm proud of coming from that. And it's important for me to share that with other people so my ancestry continues to be passed down to the next generation.
Can you describe a tradition or practice that you've learned from your family then?
Sure. You know, part of the tradition of being Creole is the food and the music. You know, we come from Zydeco music. Zydeco music is that beautiful blend of bluegrass and country and blues all wrapped up together. And I love being part of that scene and attending Zydeco concerts and festivals because it reminds me of where I come from. Same thing with food. I come from a place where the food is unique and different than anywhere else in America. You know, you're not going to get gumbo outside of Louisiana the way we make gumbo. Now, gumbo does exist in Mississippi and Alabama and into the Carolinas, but there's something a little bit different than the gumbo in Louisiana because we're French-based. So we have a roux that we own. A roux is this beautiful browned starter sauce that you make with flour and fat, and you just sit there for hours blending this on a cast iron skillet for 2 to 3 hours just to get it to the right blend before you start making your gumbo. That's culture. That's heritage. That's dedication. You know, you can't get that anywhere else but coming from Louisiana.
Thank you. And then back to your childhood, how would you describe your childhood and how does it differ from what you're seeing today in experiences?
You know, I'm lucky enough to have worked out to work in education. And so I've been able to continue to see how young people are being developed. You know, social emotional learning is really important now. How do you relate to other people? You know, we're now in an era where I feel like in order for us to understand how to get people to connect together, to not be polar opposites of each other and fighting and whatever it is that keeps us from being together, that I rely on the my old way of thinking and how where I come from in my childhood, which is we had to rely on each other. We had to rely on the ecosystem of other people helping each other to survive. Because when you come from an oppressed group, especially in a place like Louisiana, where life is divided between colored and white, right? You're black or brown, you're a person of color, and then you're white. And it's very clearly defined, right? And so the white folks were not there for you, they're there for money. And so they separated you so they can still take your money, right? You go drink at this water fountain or you have your lunch on this counter. You can't have your lunch at the counter. Have your lunch in a stool somewhere else, but they still want your money. So I come from a place where you actually have to learn how to navigate the world in a collective space where you actually have to rely on each other to survive. I feel like that is true today, where in order for us to better understand each other, because right now we're in an era where they're polar opposites, right? You can be left or the right, you can be liberal or conservative. They're just polar opposites of each other and they're constantly at war with each other. And because we start seeing ourselves in our own identity as being tribal, right? You're part of me or you're not part of me. Then therefore I'm not gonna love you because you don't think like I do. And so for us to survive and move forward in this collective manner, we need to know each other. We need to get back to our root understanding of who our neighbors are. And I feel like my childhood was that I had this great opportunity to understand how I can function with other people, because that's how I grew up. I grew up with understanding who impacts me. And if someone does one thing, it's going to have an effect on someone else. And so we're being mindful of each other and understanding what more can we do for each other besides just for ourselves. I think that we need that today more than ever. And my childhood's given that to me. So today I'm consulting with nonprofits and business leaders and better understanding what it means to come from an oppressed group. So that when they're designing something for other people, they actually have a voice in their ear that's telling them, are you creating harm when you're designing this? Because I see harm with what you're doing, because I've experienced a pattern that you're designing around. And so that's important for me today, for my lived experience I can bring forward to give to other people.
Have you seen any difference from in the past? A lot of times hate and disagreements were solely based on race and ethnicity and backgrounds. Do you see today a shift in not only the hate still being there, but maybe not only in the race or the ethnic backgrounds?
For sure. I think that you know, life becomes more complicated as you get older because you see more things, right? And I think that today we've advanced a number of different rights. Women have more rights than they did back in the 60s, though we're seeing that their biological rights are being questioned or taken away from them when it comes to their autonomy around gender. And then when you look at things such as LGBTQ rights, you know, we weren't talking about that in the 50s and so on, and into the 60s. It was only around 69, 70 when we actually start talking openly around gender issues or sexuality issues in that particular way. It's taken that 50 something years like that to advance those rights to go forward. And so when I think about today, I think about where I started from in my own life, I've seen great advancements, but I'm also seeing a sliding back in rights and who has access to those rights. We're lucky here in Washington State because we live in a very progressive state, which is actually gonna continue to challenge the imagination of other people and saying, you believe in this one thing, such as gender equality or something else that might be related to race, but is that your reality? Because it's one thing for you to legislate and create laws about what you're fearful of versus what your reality is. That's our biggest challenge today. I see what's going on in Tennessee and Florida, in Alabama, and so these southern states that are passing, some Midwest states that are passing these laws that are based on their imagination, drag queen shows, things like that, that people have never experienced in their lives, but they want to dictate laws against them because in their imaginations, those things are wrong. And that's the challenge we have today. We have the challenge of people who are trying to control society based on their imagination versus what their lived experience or the reality is. People are creating laws about things that don't exist in their own community, but it sounds right to them and they feel like they could get to win when they pass these laws because they feel like they get to protect whatever they think is normal. But that's not the reality of the people around them. And sometimes that's their own family members. And that's the hardest thing to overcome today.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you taking your time and conducting this interview with me. Is there anything else you'd like us to know about your history or anything that you might deem important to your experiences in the world?
You know, I would say one thing to that I would encourage the students at Franklin Pierce to focus on. It's not about me. I would love for you all to focus on the land that you come from, that you reside on. Because when you dig into the story about the indigenous people of this land and what they've contributed to the greatness of our society, you're gonna learn so much more about yourself. And you're gonna hold more pride in coming from Parkland and Midland and Summit and Waller communities. You are at this most amazing space where the Nisqually and the Puyallup and the Steilacoom people and the Muckleshoot people, they all converged right here in this community to conduct community. and they welcomed other people. They were the diplomats of tribes in our region. They're the ones who created inclusive societies. When the British came, the British came and learned Chinook language to better understand the people that were original to this land. And they formed this amazing, beautiful community right here in the Parkland area. And we've lost that. We don't know that knowledge. So don't focus on me. Focus on the original people of this land. Because when you learn that lesson, you'll hold so much more pride in where you come from.
Thank you.